Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good day, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to this week's edition of Here's to Your Health. I'm your co-host, Dr. Ron Epley, and unfortunately, Dr. Goforth is unable to get through on the phone yet, but he should be joining us here momentarily. Okay, so you just got me for right now, so you don't get the exciting Dr. Goforth. Anyway, so I wanted to start off today with this one. This is kind of funny. It says, drinking alcohol is the key to living past 90 years old. So we've noticed a commonality, and I think they have too when they wrote this article, and that commonality was people who are living past 100 all the time. They keep saying that, well, the key to my long life is I drink a bottle of wine or two bottles of wine every day or something like that. I never drank any water since I was 60 years old. We keep hearing stuff like that. So I kind of find it quite interesting. It's a little bit of a paradox in that alcohol is definitely a toxin and definitely poisonous to it. And yet it has some beneficial effects, like it calms you down or helps you relieve stress. It's kind of nice. I mean, I enjoy it. I enjoy going home at the end of the day, and not every day, but periodically, and having a glass or two of wine. And it does definitely reduce stress. I noticed with other people around me, if you pull out a glass of wine or a glass of beer or something, or a bottle of beer, and share it before dinner or something, and they get more talkative, they loosen up, they relax from a hard day's work. So it's not 100% surprising that that's what it was. It says, the study began in 2003 to explore the impact of daily habits on longevity. Researchers discovered that subjects who drank about two glasses of beer or wine a day were 18% less likely to experience a premature death. Huh. I wonder if they factored in the premature death of dying from drunk driving. Meanwhile, participants who exercised 15 to 45 minutes a day cut the same risk by only 11%. So it looked like the alcohol worked better than exercise. And here's what the researchers say. I have no explanation for it, but I do firmly believe that moderate drinking improves longevity. It was at the American Association for the Advancement of Science annual conference in Houston, Texas, or in Austin, Texas, sorry. Other factors that were found to boost longevity, including your weight, participants who were slightly overweight but not obese, cut their odds of early death by 3%. So again, that's one of those things that I've always said, you know, when people always wanted a fat baby when that baby was born, and you know, back in the day, with all the disease and all the sickness out there, it was baby needs a little bit of fat to live on to survive in the early days. And I always noticed the same thing in my clinic too. I see that my healthiest patients generally are a little bit overweight, and I mean, if you look at it on the body mass index scale, they're just slightly overweight. They're not a lot, and you know, I always did a little bit better when I was a little bit overweight, too. And again, it's for when you're sick, you know, you don't feel like eating much. You kind of need something to live on when you get the cold or flu of the year. Let's see. It's, what else it says? It's not bad to be skinny when you're young, but it's very bad to be skinny when you're old. Subjects who kept busy with their daily hobbies 2 hours a day were 21% less likely to die early. Thank you. While those who drank two cups of coffee a day cut their risk by 10%. So look at that. A lot of the stuff that we were told was bad for us turned out to be good. Coffee's good. A little bit of alcohol is good. Being a little bit overweight's good. It's kind of amazing, huh? Okay, here's a on this new study. Men are more attractive when desired by other women. That's a dub. My office manager is sitting here laughing. Yeah. So, I think everybody already knows that. But the reason I printed it out is because everybody knows it. It's the fact that we spend all kinds of money on studies like this, on stuff that everybody always already knows. Flu vaccine truth, it's even less effective than what we've been told. Okay? When the Wall Street Journal carries a headline like flu lacked have been earlier estimates, you know it's time to be afraid, according to the author of this article. This year's flu vaccine is slightly less effective overall. The facts are simple. In a year where the flu has taken on epidemic proportions, the flu shot currently in circulation only promises to protect and measly 36% of the people. So, I mean, if that's all it does, it protects 36% of the people. And that's this estimate. There's actually more stuff that says it may only be effective in maybe 10% or less people. So it's kind of spooky when the government's out there trying to force us all to get vaccinations. Some people are losing their jobs. I've seen a couple of YouTube postings of nurses being forced to be vaccinated, especially for the flu shot, or they lose their job. So there's some sort of, I don't know, government incentive program, from what I understand, that they got to be, hospitals have to be like 90% compliant with current vaccine schedules, or they lose some sort of federal funding. And the flu shot is one of the ways they help get their vaccination rate higher. It's only 10% effective, so, or according to this article, 32% effective. So what's the purpose? Looks like it's more of a risk than benefit. Okay, here's an article. It says, running the brain stave off the effects of chronic stress. The study finds that running mitigates the negative impacts of chronic stress has on the hippocampus, a part of the brain responsible for learning and memory. So we've always said that movement, anyway, also stimulates the brain for memory. It stimulates the brain for learning, stimulates the brain for many things, but it's one of the reasons we talk about movement. It also, movement goes over and turns off the stress area of the brain, or it tones it down, not necessarily turns it off. And so this is this study from Brigham Young University kind of confirms what we've been telling people for quite some time. Okay, North American Menopause Society, NAMS is what it's called, climb the stairs to lower blood pressure and strengthen leg muscles. New study demonstrates the effectiveness of stair climbing in helping prevent and treat menopause and age-related vascular complications and muscular weakness. So I will say stair climbing is a pretty effective exercise. My ex-wife, after we were divorced, she put on some weight, just like I did, and she was hitting the gym a couple hours a day, and it was just totally ineffective. And I was talking to her one day about, you know, she worked in my office. We're on the second floor, so she had to go up and down the stairs several times during the day. And then we also live on a two-story house, so she had to do that all the time. So she gave up at the gym. Her sister bought her a Fitbit. And what she did was, she was like, I think on the third floor. So she, about every hour or so, she set the timer and she walked for 5 minutes, turned around and walked back and up the stairs for the next 5 minutes. And she did that and kind of lost all the weight that she had gained. And she didn't have to hit the gym for hours at a time that she was doing, and it worked out quite well. So this doesn't surprise me. Climbing stairs lowers your blood pressure. Not surprising at all. Okay, so here we go again with cell phone radiation. A new study linked cell phone radiation to heart and brain tumors. Okay, it says, this is from drmercola.com. It's an article from him. He's got a few things that he says here. In 2011, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the cancer research arm of the World Health Organization, declared cell phones a group 2B possible carcinogen. Now, I don't know what 2B is, or 1A, or 10C. I have no idea what they are, but that's what he's writing. Two government-funded studies bring renewed attention to this link. The studies in which 3,000 animals were exposed to the type of radiation emitted by 2G and 3G cell phones are said to be the most extensive to date. Male rats were more likely to develop heart tumors, while female rats and newborns exposed to high levels of radiation during pregnancy and lactation were more likely to have low body weight. DNA damage and damage to heart tissue was also observed in both male and female rats, but not mice. Other types of tumors occurred in both types of animals, including brain, prostate, liver, and pancreatic tumors. The primary hazard of cell phone radiation is not brain cancer, but rather systemic cellular and mitochondrial damage that threatens health in general and can contribute to any number of health problems and chronic diseases. Okay, I'm concerned about it so much that I purchased a device to put on my cell phone. It's called, I think, an R2L device. It turns radiation into light. I don't remember the exact numbers of the conversion factor, but it converts like 72-75% of the energy gets converted into light, which is actually a pretty neat thing to do. The other thing to do is just, you know, I see women do this all the time, and it drives me nuts, is they'll carry their cell phone in their bra, so they'll see them coming to the clinic, or I know other people, with their businesses, people will come in, they'll pull out their cell phone, the women will pull out their cell phone from their bra, and they're going, oh my God, that's absolutely crazy. And so when I'm in the office and I use a cell phone, I always put them on speakerphone. If I'm using the phone in public, I shouldn't say always, because I do protect some people's privacy, but I try to keep it on speakerphone and keep the cell phone at least 4 inches away from me at all times. I don't carry a cell phone in my pocket, rarely, if ever. I just don't like them that close to my body. And it's not just the new studies. We've been doing this radio show for 10, 11, 12 years now. And I remember when some of the talk on cell phones was considered conspiracy theory crap. And I saw them then, and I thought there was looked like there was some merit behind the concerns. And now we have some pretty good solid science showing that cell phone radiation is linked to heart and brain tumors, amongst other things. So, what are we going to do? I mean, that's a huge dilemma, right? What do we do as a society when we have cell phones causing cancer? Are we going to ban them? Seems to me we ban food additives and preservatives that cause cancer. So why not cell phones? I don't think they ever will, because they're so ubiquitous. You know, even the President of the United States is addicted to a cell phone. So I don't think we'll ever do that. But it means it's a potential serious problem. Okay, so here's something that's not surprising. Here's the headline. It says, technology backfire. Instead of webcam consultation saving doctors time, they're actually costing more time due to technical problems. Okay, so we find this with everything we've been trying to do, switching over to electronic health records the last few years, is we've never totally successfully switched because it's been a pain. It doesn't work. It's expensive. It never works the way you want it to work. They're pretty canned reports. They don't look very good. And then the other thing is the technology fails all the time. We just had to, in my office, we just had to get the cable company. 3 months ago, they had a problem, and they're back again. They had to replace the whole cable. And we were down for almost a week. So I imagine if we lived in a big city, we wouldn't be down for that long. But it took that long to make everything happen so we can get back up and running. That doesn't count routers that decide to want to go out and die, and you have to go get another one, get everything all set up, new passwords, new everything set up on them. Computer systems that decide they want to die on you or get a virus or something. So, yeah, I like to say that I believe that our technology is failing us at this particular point. It's becoming more problematic than what it's worth. And that's what's happening with the doctors. They're trying to do consultations online, try to save time, and it costs them more time. Even today, with technology, right now, Dr. Goforth can't call in because he was able to call my cell phone or my office phone. He's in right now.
Here we are.
You made it, huh?
Yeah, you know what I had to do? I had to actually access it through the computer. So I'm actually talking to you through my computer right now because I couldn't call in.
Ah.
The 347-989 number, 872,
yeah.
That is not, it's not working today.
Huh. Well, were you listening to me while you're trying to get in?
No, I couldn't get anything. I was able to just barely get here to the office and get on.
Well, I'll back up to what we were talking about, because you called in just as we were talking about technology failure. Here's what it says. Technology backfire. Instead of webcam consultations saving doctors' time, they're actually costing more time due to technical problems.
Yep, I can believe that. So I know this has been kind of a pain in the butt today.
Yeah, well, it's not, and that's just for our radio show. That
right.
Doesn't count all the technology issues that we end up having for electronic health records, right?
Right, exactly right. I've had lots of technical issues with my medical records.
Yeah. And not just with the electronic health records, but just the office in general. Because I was just saying that I had to replace my cable last Friday in order to get web access or in order to get internet in the office. And then, you know, we have routers that go out periodically, and we have a computer system that decide they want to update or get a virus or something. And it's almost like not worth having technology anymore because there's so many problems associated with it. And then if you have a problem, Dr. Goforth, and you call in, they go, well, contact your IT department. Are you kidding me?
Right.
Now everybody has to have an IT department now. So you have another employee who your technology was supposed to replace an employee, but now you have to have more employees just to deal with the technical problems.
Right. So when you call in and you tell them you are the IT department, it becomes a bigger issue.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm the IT department.
But that's what I tell them. So, are you kidding me? Where are you calling from? You live in Phoenix, Arizona, where you have a population of 2 or 3 million? It's like, yeah, I understand it. I'm in a town of 4,000 people.
Right.
We don't even know what the word – we think IT is a Stephen King movie.
Right. Yep. Or what is that? A noun or something like that, too. It's a word.
Yep.
It's a word that describes itself.
So here's something that one of the ladies that worked for me found an interesting article that I found. It says, when it comes to our brains, there's no such thing as normal.
Okay.
Here's what it says.
I can believe that.
There's nothing wrong with being a little weird. So I guess there's nothing wrong with me, Dr. Goforth.
Right.
You're more than... Well, there definitely is something wrong with you. But anyway, because we think of psychological disorders on a continuum, We may worry when our ways of thinking and behaving don't match up with our idealized notion of health, but some variability can be healthy and even adaptive, say researchers, even though it can be can also complicate attempts to identify standardized markers of pathology, right?
Right.
So, well, we already figured out there's no such thing as normal anyway, because it's just a statistical average. So if you have 10 people that walk for office and you measure their height and weight, and then you calculate what the average is, not a single one of them is average.
Right.
Because there's not a single one will fit within what they consider normal. I remember in college, and you do too, when you look at the anatomy books and like they say something like the shape of the stomach, or you watch the news or commercials on TV, they have a shape of a stomach being a certain way. And yet when you look back at the original Gray's Anatomy, they had 10 different shapes of stomach. And I had no clue until I got that original book and looked at it. And you're going, oh, my God, I guess the stomach varies back then by 10 different ones. And it probably, if we look at it, no two are probably the same.
Right.
And yet we believe it's a certain thing. So what really is normal?
Right.
There is no normal.
That's correct. I was going to say, that makes sense with the brain, you know, no normal brain, because I've met a lot of wackadoodles. And I'm sure people have called me a wackadoodle as well. So,
yeah
that makes sense.
Yeah, in fact, so many wackadoodles, it's like, well, that's got to be what's normal.
Yeah, that's
Does
right.
Everybody
Maybe I'm the weird one.
That's I've had to think about that several times.
Yeah, that makes sense.
There's one from the University of Eastern Finland that says depression is linked to reduced arginine levels. It says people suffering from major depressive disorder have reduced arginine levels, a new study says. Let me read this because this is interesting. Published in the Journal of Affective Disorders. It says people suffering from major depressive disorder, MDD, have reduced arginine levels, a new study from the University of Eastern Finland shows. Arginine is an amino acid which the body uses to reduce nitric oxide. Nitric oxide, in turn, is a nervous system and immune defense mediator and also plays a role in vascular regulation. The global arginine bioavailability ratio is an indicator of the body's arginine levels, and the ratio has previously been used to measure the body's capacity to produce nitric oxide. Reduced arginine bioavailability is also known to be an independent risk factor of cardiovascular. So interesting, huh?
Yeah.
But here's what I don't get. I don't get if reduced arginine causes depression or people that are depressed end up with depleted arginine.
Yeah, that's a good question, right?
But yeah, so arginine is an amino acid, right?
Yep.
That's what they say. So you should be able to get arginine from eating a protein-based diet.
Right.
So are these people also maybe somewhat protein deficient if they're not getting enough?
Yeah, maybe they're vegetarians or vegans or something, huh?
Yeah. Or even if they're not, they just eat way too many carbs, way too much.
Right.
Not enough meat and not enough vegetables. Speaking of that, this is a pretty good segue. Low fat or low carb? It's a draw, according to a new study. It says new evidence might dismay those who have chosen sides in the low fat versus low carb diet debate. Cutting either carbs or fat shaves off excessive weight in about the same proportion, according to the study.
Huh.
But,
well,
here's what
I don't know about that.
Well, we've always said from a paleo standpoint that people need more protein and more vegetables.
Right.
So if they're cutting out the carbs, obviously we see that. If they're cutting out some of the fat, obviously we're seeing that too. Just eat more protein and more vegetables, and that's actually more the key than cutting all the other crap out.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense to me too.
Yeah, well, and I'm not sure 100% that I believe the low fat thing, because we've read lots and lots of the studies on the fat thing, and it being not that effective.
Right.
But according to this study, they found there was really no difference. It's also possible in here that what they did is they cut calories too, right?
Right.
I can't see exactly what they did, but anyway. So this is another interesting study, which I never thought of before. It says leading cardiologists and high altitude physicians have drawn up recommendations for cardiovascular patients in high mountainous regions. And it says a trip to the mountains is good for your heart. It says cardiologists are in agreement that generally exercise in the mountains is a very good way to prevent or reduce the occurrence of cardiovascular diseases. Nevertheless, those people who have a pre-existing cardiovascular condition, under what circumstances is it safe to reside or holiday in high mountain regions? And what they're basically saying is, it's good for you to go to the mountains.
Yeah.
It's good for your heart.
No,
I don't know what it is. Yeah, I don't know what it is about.
Right. It has to be less oxygen, right?
Less oxygen.
Right, that's what it has to be. Because your body, your cardiovascular system actually has to work. So it's kind of like working out in a way. You have more platelets and stuff in your body. I mean, eventually, it doesn't take too long to adapt to it. But I'm not sure exactly. But that's my assumption. That's how it works there.
Yeah, I couldn't quite figure it out either when I was looking at it. It's like, maybe it is sort of like exercise without exercising as much as you want to. Maybe just going to the mountains and walking around is equivalent to getting more exercise. But also, would it be safe? That's the other thing. If you got heart disease and all of a sudden you're in a low oxygen environment, is that safe or not?
Right.
Looks like
it
is.
Huh. Interesting.
Okay, so here's another interesting thing about pain relief, right? It says how a combination of exercise and music helps us feel less pain. Pain is essential for survival. However, it can also slow rehabilitation or can become a distinct disorder. How strongly we feel it depends on our individual pain threshold. Scientists have discovered that this threshold can be increased by a new fitness method called Diamond or whatever, I don't know. A combination of working out on gym machines with free musical improvisation and makes us feel less sensitive towards physical discomfort.
Huh. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, listen to music while you're working out and feel less pain.
Okay, well, that's a common thing. I mean, a lot of people do that.
Yeah, a lot of people do, don't they?
Keep your brain busy, though.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the thing that's being bored out of your mind, sitting there lifting weights or whatever.
God, that's the one thing I hate about exercise. It's just so boring. I can compete. I can play basketball or football or soccer, you name it. If it's a competitive sport, I can play it until I fall on my face and with exhaustion. I enjoy it, but man, the sheer tedium of going to the gym and working out. Ugh.
Right. Yeah, I have a hard time with the gym, but that's why I can ride my bicycle, because the scenery changes. I'm active and the scenery changes, and I can stop anytime I need to.
Yeah. Especially on hills.
Yeah, right. Yep, especially on the hills. Going down, you have to stop more often, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Going down, you may actually come to that sudden stop at the end, right?
That's right. I've only ever really on purpose stopped once going down a hill. That was because I was somewhere I had never been before and wanted to stop and take a picture.
So where are we going? We got another study here saying the same thing we've said over and over again. Physical exercise reduces the risk of developing diabetes.
Right.
And also helps people have diabetes. Okay, so I remember first hearing about this thing that's in this study from, I remember reading or hearing about it from Dr. Murphy several times, so I'll read you what it says. So the pilot study in Kenya shows a link between chronic pain and glutamate consumption.
Right. I remember that from Murphy, too. Well, now you say it.
Yeah. Yeah, but what's funny is this one says a pilot study. In other words, it looks like they've never done the study before, and yeah, Murphy talked about it for years.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, it says here glutamate is a naturally occurring chemical in some foods, like soy sauce and Parmesan cheese, but is more commonly found as a food additive. In the U.S., glutamate is added to many food products and found under many names, including MSG or monosodium glutamate, hydrolyzed protein, protein isolate, protein extract, and autolyzed yeast extract, to just name a few. I remember Murphy talking about like 38 different names for MSG.
Right. Yeah, I remember something about that too. Good luck trying to remember all those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
so it's easy to avoid. You just can't eat anything processed.
Right. Right. Yeah, let's see. What does it say here? Study participants experienced chronic pain for at least 6 months or more and in at least 3/4 of their body, similar to what was seen in widespread chronic pain patients in the U.S. Most also suffer from other neurological symptoms, including headaches or migraines, chronic fatigue, cognitive dysfunction, and sleep issues, which all of them improve when they remove glutamate from their diet.
Right.
So anyway, yeah. So Dr. Murphy was, looks like he's ahead of his time, huh?
Yeah, he is. He has been for a long time, though.
Yeah, yeah. He's actually going to be in Portland this weekend, him and Dr. Chestnut at the Oregon conventions.
Oh.
Friday and Saturday.
Oh, the winter convention, huh? Cool.
Yeah, well, it's one of the conventions about concussions.
Right.
I would go, but it's just Friday, and I don't want to take Friday off.
Yeah. I would go, too, but I don't want to take the extra time off, and I already have my hours this year.
Yep, I do too. So, here's another study. It says a carbohydrate-restricted diet helps improve metabolism for people that have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, helps fight that disease. Well, carb works all over the place, doesn't it?
Yep. Good stuff.
Oh, here's a. I just found this article interesting. That's the reason I printed it out. It has nothing to do with health. It says evidently Qantas Airlines, they have a biofuel powered airliner, and it requires 150 acres of farmland to grow the fuel for a single flight.
Wow. That doesn't seem very cost effective.
No. Anyway, this is the world's first biofuel flight between the U.S. and Australia, and it was Qantas Airlines, and they're all happy that they're able to do that. But this is something that you know, so we got to use 150 acres of farmland just for one flight.
Right.
So I don't, that's good farmland that we could put, grow food for human consumption. So what are we going to do? Use up all our land because we don't want to burn oil and we're going to burn all our food up. What are we going to eat?
I was wondering that, too. Maybe we'll just have to eat the airplanes.
Yeah, well, so we're just going to starve people to death, and then there won't be any people to fly.
Right?
Yeah. I always thought that was crazy, mixing ethanol into the fuel. I think they're crazy.
Yeah, me too. It's not a very fuel efficient. The fuel is not very efficient.
No, I don't think it is either. I think it's I think it's foolish for doing what we're doing now. And the funny part is these people are patting themselves on the back. What a great accomplishment! They're saving the planet. They're not doing a darn thing. They're starving people is what they're doing.
Right. Exactly right.
Here's a article. It's the pros and cons of paleo, low carb, and fasting diets. And here's what they found. What they all have in common is lots of fresh vegetables.
Right. Vegetables are good for you. No doubt about it.
So I'll read what it says here because we got plenty of time. Low carb diet. Low carb diets such as Atkins, Dukin, and POP or whatever they are. They limit the take of carbohydrates, which include those found in grains, starchy vegetables, and fruits, and highlight foods rich in protein and fat. Low carb diets are typically used for losing weight. However, these diets are deemed harmful. Carbohydrates are broken down into glucose, which prompts the release of insulin, and insulin aids the storing of energy as food is fat, particularly in the belly. However, carbohydrates are not the only ones that stimulate the production of insulin in the body, but also foods rich in protein and fat, too. Anyway, paleo diet is based on what the cavemen ate or did not eat in the Paleolithic period, which is, here's some of the side effects of the paleo diet. Diarrhea, headaches, and weakness. That's what they say. Fasting diet, 5-2 diet, and the warrior diet are types of intermittent fasting diets that are used for weight loss. These diets typically involve consuming little to no calories for 14 to 36 hours. But anyway, what they all have found to have is they all want people to eat lots of vegetables.
Right.
And that's probably why they all work, huh?
Yep.
For losing weight.
Well, it's interesting, though, the paleo causes what they said, weakness and diarrhea and stuff like that. And every time I tried it never had that effect on me. Not saying that I have to have all the side effects, but I just found it interesting.
Well, I think what happens is people go a little nuts, right?
Yeah.
They don't eat all the vegetables that they should eat, because I don't have any problems with paleo either. In fact, it has the opposite effect on me. It works really well to fix my gut up. But, however, if I were to just go home and eat a big old steak and that's it, I could have some of the side effects of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So people can, and I know that's what they do. When they switch to paleo, they start thinking, I can eat all the steak and all the meat I want, and they still forget to add more vegetables to their diet. So,
right.
I can see some of it.
Right.
So.
Yep, that's what I try to tell my patients when I'm telling them to do paleo, is to just do, the protein the size of your palm and the carbs, you cup your hand full of, full of that. That's your carbs. And then the rest of the plate is all vegetables. You need as many vegetables as you want.
Pretty much unlimited vegetables.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anytime you overdo with anything, you can have problems.
Well, of course.
So listen to this. Brain trauma at any point in life increases the risk of later dementia by 600%.
Wow. That's kind of scary.
Yeah, no kidding. It says a traumatic brain injury increases the risk of a person developing dementia by 80%, even 15 to 30 years later after the incident. In the largest study observing the connection between traumatic brain injury and dementia risk, scientists from Umeå University have concluded that victims of traumatic brain injury should take special care in preserving their brain health. It is apparent that the side effects of TBI are long-lasting and can manifest themselves decades after the initial injury.
Hmm.
So,
wow.
I think the chiropractic profession is beginning to step up in our care for brain injuries. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. It's coming along.
And, yeah, we still got a lot of work to do. I need a lot more education myself, but what I'm happy with my what I was able to do is my nephew came to me after a car wreck, and I was able to discover the brain injury pretty really quick, where the hospital didn't.
Right.
So, but it doesn't mean I know that much. I just know enough to be scary.
Yeah, right.
But, and we need to learn a lot more. But so if these concussions could really seriously affect our health, and these doctors now are saying that we need to take special care in preserving our brains, then maybe as chiropractors, we really, really, really need to start pushing things like vitamin B6 and fish oil and vitamin D and
right.
chiropractic care, stuff like that, to help the brain that could help the brain. Because what is the medical profession?
Yeah, they're not there doing it, are they?
Yeah, they're not doing much. So I think we need to step up to do it. And what do you do? But also, here we go. Remember when you weren't at that seminar with me. I was at a seminar and they were talking about leaky gut syndrome caused by that's caused after a brain injury. And now I'm seeing it written everywhere. Even in this article, it says the brain-gut connection. New study finds a traumatic brain injury also causes intestinal damage.
Right. So I remember that because you told that to me, which I still thought was
This is just an interesting thing of what to do for people that have these problems, right? Maybe we have patients for life because we got to really work on preserving the brain, their brain health. I think it's important.
Yep.
Okay, so listen to this. Children who use smart assistants like Alexa and Siri are forgoing manners altogether.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, they seem to forget their manners when talking to other people. They kind of boss them around and act like other people are Siri, right? They ask rude questions.
Right.
I mean, I remember you and I both. We went to Bend, Oregon, I think, and it was for the seminar for the Department of Transportation Physicals, and I think didn't I have a new smartphone, and I think you did too back then, and we were playing with
right.
Siri, right?
Right.
So we were using all kinds of smart aleck comments to Siri,
right?
You remember that?
Right. Yep.
It was funny as hell. But anyway, imagine kids that get Siri and they're being a smart aleck to Siri, and Siri, can you do this? Siri, can you do that? Well, it looks like, according to this study, is these people are totally forgetting their manners, and they treat other people like they do when they're asking Siri for some information.
Hmm.
Mom, make me a sandwich.
Right.
No, please, can you make me a sandwich? Right? It's just, make me a sandwich.
Yep. Of course, I chuckle. I remember that. If I would have done that when I was a kid, it would have been smack.
So I remember playing with Siri during that seminar. It's like, Siri, call me master, 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 master.
Right.
Yeah, yes, master, 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 master. Anyway, it's funny. Yeah, you thought I forgot about how silly we were. Anyway.
Right.
Research confirms eating a variety of real food and staying physically active is the key to lasting brain health.
Right.
So, again, Dr. Goforth, this leads me to this thing of, remember years ago when we were starting to see all this stuff on probiotics, and we're going, oh, my God, if we started over in practice knowing what we know now, that we might actually be probiotic specialists and dealing with that for people's health. Now look at what we almost have a new profession that needs to emerge for dealing with people's brain health.
Right.
So here's what the food does. It says berries. Opt for fresh berries over juice. Fresh berries have a more robust nutritional profile and are less likely to have preservatives and additives mixed in with them. And it says a study finds berries clear amyloid brain tangles to help fight Alzheimer's dementia, which we talked about before. Fresh vegetables, in addition to berries, is needed. Nuts, healthy fats, which are, again, olive oil, safflower oil, fishy, fatty fish and seafood. Avoid processed and packaged foods. Whole fat, dairy, and red meat, food items, cheese, butter, and pork contain saturated fats and trans fats that are unhealthy. What else do you do? It says stay active, avoid overeating, limit alcohol, and prepare meals at home.
Yep.
So it's starting to look like that there's almost needs to be a separate specialty in people just helping people with their brain health.
Right.
So why
what's funny is, what's funny about that is if you help your brain health, you get to help your general health too.
Oh, it's kind of funny how it just follows that, right?
Yeah, right. Imagine that.
Yeah, imagine that. Yeah, it's got me a little excited reading this. And just the thoughts of becoming brain specialists, right? I don't think it'd be that hard, because you know it wouldn't be that hard, but that would be totally cool. God, I almost wish that the chiropractic profession would step up a little bit more and get more specialists, like because I'm a CCWP, right? I'm a certified chiropractic wellness practice. I'd like to see something on certified chiropractic brain specialists or something like that, right?
Right. That'd be fun, huh?
Okay, you know what else you can do to protect your brain? Listen to this. Go for a brisk walk every day to protect your brain.
Right. That's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, pun intended, right?
That's correct. Pun intended.
So listen to this. This I found quite fascinating. It says, competition for attention in social media world. Global demand for plastic surgery is way, way up.
Really?
Yep.
That's interesting.
Yep. It's one of the reasons I decided to buy the laser for body contouring is because of that, so we can do something safe and effective for people without doing drugs or surgery, right? Which is what chiropractors believe in. Why, one of the reasons I did it. And now there's studies confirming that, wow, there's a huge demand for that. But listen to how far this goes. This is crazy. It says, the demand for plastic surgery has gone way up, especially with both men and women's desires to be constantly attractive, not only in real life, but also, and sometimes even more so, in social media. For instance, women who searched for a designer vagina have increased by 45% in 2016 as compared to data from 2015, making labiaplasty one of the most sought-after cosmetic procedures in the modern world.
Designer vagina.
Yeah, who would have thunk it?
I got stuck right there. I couldn't even imagine. what else do you need to do to it?
I know, but it's the most sought after. Yeah, I know. Is that crazy?
Absolutely. That is the most craziest thing I think I've heard maybe ever. I just don't understand that at all. That's beyond my comprehension.
Yeah, okay. It wasn't just labiaplasty that experienced major growth within the last years. Breast augmentation was still the most popular cosmetic procedure in 2016, representing 15.8% of all cosmetic surgeries. Liposuction cinched the second spot with 14%. Eyelid surgery, 12.9%. Rhinoplasty or nose job, 7.6%.
I can almost see those.
Those,
yeah.
The life of
always
been around. Yeah. Right. But, just learn something new every day, don't we?
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, what do we got here? So, I got two last articles to go over, so we might finish this a couple minutes early because I want a little faster without you being on for the first 15 minutes. So, here we go. One of them is magnesium, and I wanted to talk about magnesium because this was on Dr. Mercola's website. It says one of the most important nutrients for heart health. And I wanted to bring it up because I've used it for my heart, and it works wonders, and I've been out of it for a while. And I walked into my office today, and I started to get, my heart started to jump around a little bit. And I'm going, oh, my God, I got to get back on my magnesium. So I took it, and it's all better again. So also, I did some research lately, and I'm going to start doing testing of people for magnesium, just like I do for vitamin D and fish oil now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because it really is. Remember, we were talking about Dr. Murphy, too. Dr. Murphy thinks that everybody needs to be taking magnesium every day. And so I just decided I'm going to start testing people for it, and we'll go from there.
Yep, good idea.
Yep. I had a patient, recent new patient that came to me, and I thought his whole problem was severe magnesium deficiency. Just lifting his legs instead of, you know when you do a straight leg raise, and like if they got some sort of sciatica or something, or nerve root that get leg pain. Well, I would move him around, and he cramps everywhere. And so he just had major spasms no matter what we did.
Hmm.
Anyway. So magnesium, here's the story at a glance. Magnesium is the fourth most abundant mineral in your body. It's involved in more than 600 different biochemical reactions. Research suggests even subclinical deficiency can jeopardize your heart health. A lack of magnesium will impede your cellular metabolic function and deteriorate mitochondrial function, and magnesium deficiency has been identified as the greatest predictor of heart disease.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, did you hear that? Not your cholesterol levels, but magnesium.
Yeah, right.
Magnesium is also important for chromosome folding, which allows cells to divide, multiply, and regenerate to make up for loss of damaged cells.
Right.
Check your red blood cell magnesium level and track signs and symptoms of magnesium insufficiency to determine how much magnesium you need. Low potassium and calcium are also common laboratory signs which indicate magnesium deficiency.
Hmm.
So he's recommending that we do RBC magnesium testing as well.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that Murphy kept telling us about, and I kept resisting it. And then when I started having a few problems myself, and I started taking magnesium, and my roommate as well, I started going, my eyes are open now that a lot of people are magnesium deficient.
Right.
Now I'm going to test just to be sure.
Smart plan.
So now the next one here that I want to talk about is another one on Mercola, Dr. Mercola's website. And it says vitamin D3 is a powerhouse for your heart. Okay. New research suggests that vitamin D3 plays a vital role in protecting your endothelium and repairing any damage inflicted by chronic disease on this unique organ system, which lines your entire circulatory system. Earlier research suggests your endothelium can be damaged by serious health conditions such as atherosclerosis, diabetes, high blood pressure, and insulin resistance. The new findings suggest that the presence of vitamin D3 also triggers nitric oxide, a molecule known to play an important role signaling and controlling blood flow and preventing blood clot formation. Vitamin D3 significantly reduces oxidative stress in your vascular system, which can prevent the development and the progression of cardiovascular disease. If you haven't checked your vitamin D level in the past 6 months, you now have another reason to do so, to protect your heart and disease and reduce your risk of heart disease.
Right.
So there you go, Dr. Goforth. So just to remind you, I test almost all my new patients with vitamin D3 levels. I'm thinking of scheduling vitamin D testing. People come in and just be tested on a regular basis, like annually or every 6 months, just to make sure they're doing the right thing. And just to remind you that just send people to the hospital with a prescription and let them get their vitamin D check.
Yep.
Absolutely critical.
Right.
Absolutely. So, well, Dr. Goforth, you missed out on the best part of the show because I did the best in the beginning, and I left all the crappy stuff for you to go over.
Oh, well, stuff like that happens. It must have been awesome because the stuff that we went through was pretty good.
Yeah, I know.
So
anyway, so... Well, maybe next week you can make it down here live. There won't be any ice on the roads, right?
Yeah, that would be helpful. I hope so. I need to get back down there. So
yeah,
I'll be there.
Okay. So I guess that concludes today's show. So until next time, here's to your health.
Here's to your health.
I'll try to make it on.